It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The day after President Obama's final State of the Union address, joining us to analyze that address and also keep an eye on the Iowa caucuses, the beginning of the last phase of our very lengthy campaign season. Donna Hoffman is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, associate professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Tim Hagel in our Iowa City studio, associate professor at the University of Iowa. If you'd like to join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. What jumped out at you about the president's last State of the Union address? What are your thoughts, your questions about the Obama presidency as he enters his final year in office? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave a comment or question. President Obama framed his speech around what he called four big questions. I wonder if you caught them. Here they are very quickly. How do we give everyone a fair shot at opportunity and security in this new economy? Two, how do we make technology work for us, not against us, especially when it comes to solving urgent challenges like climate change? Three, how do we keep America safe and lead the world without becoming its policeman? And the last, how can we make our politics reflect what's best in us and not what's worst? This hour, we want to turn to our political analysts to get their thoughts on the president's speech, also in the context of this very surprising, fascinating presidential election cycle, also noting the fact that we are less than 20 days before the Iowa caucuses, a context that the president joked about at the very start of his speech.
Tonight marks the eighth year that I've come here to report on the State of the Union. And for this final one, I'm going to try to make it a little shorter. I know some of you are antsy to get back to Iowa. I've been there. I'll be shaking hands afterwards if you want some tips.
Okay, some of that Obama wit to start off the speech and also put it in the context as we are just in front of the 2016 elections. Donna Hoffman, how would you characterize this speech overall? You've observed now a number of the president's State of the Union addresses.
Well, you know, the administration before Obama gave this speech had signaled that it was going to be a quote-unquote untraditional speech. And it was in some respects, but in a lot of respects it wasn't. I mean, there is a basic blueprint of this particular speech. First of all, you know, the Constitution requires the president report on the State of the Union from time to time. It's a tradition that it's oral now in front of a joint session that the president appears. Usually it's once a year. He appears at the beginning of a session and he lays out an agenda. So Obama even last night said, I'm not going to, you know, give you this laundry list of legislative requests, but in fact he did. Maybe not as many as typically we see from presidents, but that still needs a little bit of analysis on my part. But the other thing that presidents do besides saying, here's the things, Congress, I'd like for you to do, is they also claim credit for things they've already done. And we saw a decent amount of that from Obama as well, which would be expected in any State of the Union address, but especially in a president's final year, so his final State of the Union address. Where the speech was characterized as untraditional, I think, by the administration and by Obama was with those four points that you mentioned, giving these themes, Obama wanting to look forward more than looking backwards. But he has done a decent amount of forward-looking, put a decent amount of forward-looking rhetoric in his previous State of the Unions as well. So in some senses, it was a bit untraditional, but at the same time, it still followed the basic blueprint. And all presidents do have the ability to deviate a little bit in terms of space they give to certain things and what they talk about and where they place it and those kinds of things.
Tim Hagel, your reaction to the speech overall?
Well, Donna's been pretty thorough in her analysis there, so I need to find a couple of holes to talk about here. I suppose one of the things that I always look for when I'm watching a speech like this is the delivery. And one of the things I noticed, it did seem that President Obama was more relaxed than usual. And it seemed in some previous speeches, whether State of the Unions or others, that I almost got the sense that he was getting tired or mailing it in. And this time I didn't see that as much. He did seem a little bit more engaged, as I said, a little bit more relaxed, although sometimes when he gets relaxed, he starts thumping on the podium, which gets picked up by the mic, which I always think of my high school speech teacher would drive her crazy as it drives me crazy. But generally, it was good speech. There was that sort of laundry list, and he was talking about things maybe not quite with the specificity that he would have in earlier speeches where he's talking about a particular legislative agenda. But he still has things that he wants to accomplish, and I think that he did lay those out accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim, what about the reaction to the speech? You said the president didn't seem like he was mailing it in. Did it seem to you in the chamber a bit more subdued? Perhaps because it's his last one of these?
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I kind of got that impression. There was the usual, and I think they said something like 70 times he was interrupted for applause, and that's no surprise. You have the applause lines. But one of the things I noticed towards the end of the speech is it seemed that he sort of shifted gears and was trying to make the speech more inspirational. And it just didn't seem to be getting the reaction, which kind of surprised me. And it was towards the end, and the speech was a little bit longer than what he was giving people the impression it was going to be, because now we're getting close to closing in on an hour, until his very final line. And then, of course, at the end, and everybody did jump up, and especially Democrats, and applauding him. But before that, he was trying to be inspirational. It didn't seem to be connecting. And I don't know if it was because Congress was tired at that point or what the problem was. But there was a different, like I say, a different tone then.
Donna, perhaps it was merely because there are fewer Democrats in both chambers than when the president took office.
Perhaps. Or, you know, perhaps it was he said, I'm going to give a shorter speech. And in fact, he didn't give a shorter mm-hmm. speech.
No,
and so they're waiting for the end of that as well. But, you know, really, in looking at the speech, I think one of the things that's really important to point out is how much it was colored by the environment in which it was given in. And by that, I don't mean the chamber per se, but by the fact that we are in the midst of the nomination campaign for both parties. And that really was the environment in which that speech was put together. There were a number of things that the president mentioned that, while he didn't address any of the Republican candidates by name, certainly were counterpoints to things that they are saying. And it wasn't just Donald Trump either.
Mm-hmm. And also in the response by Nikki Haley, we'll hear a comment, a little bit of tape on her a little bit later. But that coloring throughout, no names mentioned, Tim Hagel, but we those of us who interest ourselves in politics certainly read between the lines.
Yeah, early on, I got the impression, I thought, well, gee, this sounds an awful lot like a campaign speech rather than necessarily a State of the Union or somebody who's really governing. And that's one of the things where Obama is better. And he kind of even talks about that, where there's a difference between campaigning and governing, and you have to understand that going into it. And he had a little trouble making that distinction. But it did seem a little bit more that it was campaign-oriented. And I think part of it was because he was, as Donna was suggesting, sort of responding to some of the criticisms that he's going to get. Well, it's no surprise that an incumbent president is going to get criticized by folks in the other party during an election year or the lead up to the election year. But it was a little surprising he decided to respond to it. Again, not naming any names, but particularly noting, and we sort of people read between the lines, knew that he was talking at least to Trump, but some of the others too. And I think that was possibly because he's got this eye towards legacy. He wants to say, well, look, we have had these successes and these criticisms are baseless, and, you know, kind of that sense. He wasn't quite that direct, but that's sort of what the message was.
Well, Tim, let's go right to a part of the speech I think you're referring to. The president began very early on laying out his economic accomplishments, the creation of new jobs, decreased unemployment, the best year ever for American car companies. And he rejected any notion that the economy is floundering, went on, though, to sympathize with Americans who are still worried.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. Now, what is true, and the reason that a lot of Americans feel anxious, is that the economy has been changing in profound ways. Changes that started long before the Great Recession hit, changes that have not let up. Today, technology doesn't just replace jobs on the assembly line, but any job where work can be automated. Companies in a global economy can locate anywhere, and they face tougher competition. As a result, workers have less leverage for a raise. Companies have less loyalty to their communities. And more wealth and income is concentrated at the very top.
President Obama in his State of the Union address last night. It seemed, Donna, that much of the speech was this attempt to counter the narrative, which we've heard from the campaign trail, There we heard some of that, the decline of America. We hear from GOP candidates. Do you think he was successful?
Do I think the president was successful in countering that? Certainly he did counter that. Now, whether that's going to resonate or not, you know, really kind of remains to be seen. But at multiple points during the speech, he did make the point about the new economy, because while those indicators that he, you know, shared in the speech about the economy and the ways that it was doing better, it is still true that Americans will tell pollsters in particular that there's uncertainty in the economy, that you know, there's the difference in inequality, income inequality, for example, has grown. And what really does matter in terms of even how people vote, we know, is their perception of the economy. So we might have already started an economic recovery, just as a generic example. But if voters still feel like we're in a recession, that's what the perception is, the important thing. And so Obama had to walk a pretty fine line in saying, look, the economy is much better on these indicators than it was when I took office. And here's all the way that it's ways that it's better. But yet he also had to address the reality of the middle class in particular in feeling squeezed, that workers are being squeezed. I think he even kind of used that phrase more or less. And so he had to walk that line in terms of, yes, it is much better. It could be better. But he also wanted to point out that it's a new economy. And at multiple times he used that phrase, you know, the realities of the new economy. Here's what the new economy is about.
Join our discussion with Donna Hoffman and Tim Hagel as we discuss the last night's final State of the Union address by President Obama. Also, we'll be talking, of course, just 18 days, I believe, away from the Iowa caucuses, about the latest polls a little later in the program. Join us with your questions, your comments, what jumped out at you about the president's last State of the Union. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I wonder if on that point, when we heard the president speaking there about the concentration of wealth, a tip of the hat to the Democratic candidates, Tim Hagel there. We know they've both been talking about the income distribution, but this has really been the propellant in the rocket that has set off the Bernie Sanders campaign, right?
It has. And even though, as you say, both candidates are talking about it, and I have to imagine that, you know, President Obama may have one he favors more than the other between the two, but he has to walk a fairly fine line in trying to stay somewhat neutral between them. And so maybe it's a way to raise that issue with, and sort of let people know that he's paying attention without necessarily tipping his hat specifically to one candidate or the other.
Mm-hmm. Donna, you have observed State of the Union addresses by this president over the past few years. When you look at them, I don't know if you've had time to review them, but I know you've analyzed them in many different ways. What do you see in this one that's different? I mean, we can compare the more, I guess, inspirational, idealistic agenda setter that we had early on in the presidency.
Mm-hmm. One of the things Obama didn't do in this speech, and I believe he has done this in another speech as well, while we knew we had a list of who the president had invited and was sitting with the first lady, in the speech he didn't recognize any of those people. That is something Ronald Reagan started during his term that other presidents have followed. And usually they do it in every speech, not always, but usually. And so Obama didn't do that. And again, I think that's one of the untraditional things that you had. I think he had some references to those people, not mentioning them by name at the latter part of the speech. But, you know, that was one thing that was a little different in terms of that speech. But one of the things that in particular I look at in my own research with Allison Howard, one of my colleagues at Dominican University in California, is to look at where presidents have sought to lead Congress and where they have asked for legislative action. And so there in the speech, I expect we'll see a bit fewer of those. Again, there will still be some. But a bit fewer. And then, you know, in the year that follows the speech, do they get Congress to do any of those things or even some formulation of those things? And within the Obama presidency, there's been a lot of variability in his previous speeches. And so he had a really good year in 2010. That was his best year, where with his legislative request that he put in the State of the Union address in that year following, he got about 56% of those, some form of those through Congress. Now, that's maybe not all that surprising, given that Democrats controlled both chambers at that point. But then you had, that was his high point, you had his low point being the year after his reelection. So in 2013, he only got about 5% of those. So a lot of variability there, which is a good window just in terms of looking at the way that Obama has navigated, you know, his relationship with Congress in some respects. But he's also not out of the ordinary in that regard, because other presidents have a lot of variability within their terms as well. And so, again, Obama, any president can take this speech, basic blueprint, and put their own particular stamp on it. And Obama has done that. And we saw that last night again because he did try to incorporate some of those larger themes into it.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. He didn't point out anybody in the audience, though there was an empty chair next to Michelle Obama, I understand, for victims of to represent victims of gun violence.
That's correct. And, you know, again, oftentimes presidents will point those people out and refer to them in their speech for the symbolic value of having those people there. You know, perhaps there was a calculation made by the administration, the speechwriters in this particular speech, that, you know, we're going to put out in a press release who the guests are going to be. So that's going to get into the media anyway. People who are knowledgeable about public affairs are going to hear that anyway. So we can save the space in the speech because there is a limited amount of it for other things that the president wants to do.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about this State of the Union address being an agenda setter for the coming year, Tim Hagel, what is the common ground that you saw the president or heard the president recognize here? The shrinking common ground. What issues can the president and this Republican Congress still tackle?
Boy, that's a good one, because you often see after a State of the Union where the folks that support the president will say this is a great speech and we want to do these things, and the people that don't support the president will say pretty much the opposite. I think that there's some recognition of criminal justice reform, and you probably have other issues that you can name, but it's always a question of what it is that each party wants to do, and that's where the hang-up is in terms of trying to find some common ground to address a particular issue. And like I say, criminal justice reform is sort of one that would seem to get people on both sides of the fence saying, yes, we need to do something about this. But the question is what and how are we going to implement whatever we decide to do?
Opioid addiction, I think, was another one of those. Donna, did you spot any others?
Trade is another one that Obama hopes to get because this is an issue that appeals to Republicans, and Republicans control the two chambers. So the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership is something that he's hoping to get Congress to accept as well. And that's an issue that, you know, is problematic for him in some ways within his own party, because there's lots of Democrats that don't support that, and he has to rely on Republicans in that regard.
Isn't it also problematic in the Republican Party, trade, open borders? Isn't there a part of the Republican Party that would like to have a more protectionist stance?
Yes, and there certainly is. And again, this is an exercise in coalition building that a president has to do in regard to trade. And you know, Obama will have to do that. And whether he can do that before the end of his term remains to be seen. But that's certainly one of the things that you might see some movement on, in addition to the things that you and Tim mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan sitting behind the president, along with the vice president for the very first time. Any observations there, Tim Hagel?
Well, I was disappointed he didn't have a Packers green tie on. He had this red tie instead, although somebody suggested maybe it was because of the Wisconsin Badgers. I don't know. But it was interesting. And as I had seen someone else point out, that you had the two people that were running for vice president last time sitting behind President Obama, of course, Vice President Biden, but also Ryan, of course. And it's interesting also because of Ryan being so young, that sort of different look, I suppose. And thankfully, I guess he had shaved his beard. Not everybody liked it. I guess I was ambivalent. I didn't really care. But it was interesting to see someone new behind the president.
Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan, did you note anything different about Paul Ryan? Or did he? I mean, it's always interesting. This is a curious sort of thing you watch for over an hour in this case, where very much part of the presentation are these two faces and how they react to what the president says, Donna.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty interesting contrast, I think, with the previous speaker, John Boehner. He had his poker face down, I think, pretty well. There wasn't a lot of emotion out of him. At times, I thought that maybe he had fixed a point in the back of the chamber that he was just going to look at to steal his reactions. But I thought he didn't make himself the subject of media reports, and that's usually a pretty good thing if you're one of those two people sitting in the background.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the way this was framed in those four questions, Donna, that I named at the outset? Particularly, what does this tell us about how the Democrats see the greatest challenges this country faces compared with the Republicans?
Well, I don't know that I'd bring all the Democrats in on this, because this very much was Obama's speech, I think. And so one of the things that I thought was quite interesting that I really did not expect Obama to do related to the third point, where he was talking about keeping America safe and leading the world without being the world's policeman. And so Obama has been very criticized by Republicans for being too tepid, for not having what they think is a suitable strategy in terms of the, terrorism and Syria and the Middle East and various things. And Obama is a person, when he gives a speech, that does go into nuance. And so to him, and he's a lawyer, constitutional law, you know, scholar, he does see the world in shades of gray. And that's a little unusual in terms of politicians, at least in terms of how they speak about things. And so he does this nuance that sometimes does not really register well. And we really saw that, I think, in terms of when he unpacked his that third argument, keeping America safe, because he talked about his number one priority in terms of foreign policy is combating terrorism. But he said, you know, we shouldn't associate ISIS and Al-Qaeda with the world's largest religion. We should call them killers and maniacs or fanatics, I think is what he said.
Let's listen to that. Since you're on the topic right here, we have to go to break. But let's listen to this cut. The president spent a lot of time talking about keeping America safe, rejecting the idea that ISIS posed a dire threat to the U.S. and leveled criticism against some of the Republican candidates and how they've characterized this threat.
Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions. We just need to call them what they are, killers and fanatics, who have to be rooted out, hunted down, and destroyed.
On this Politics Wednesday, talking about last night's State of the Union address by President Obama, what do you think about the way the president characterizes the threat posed by ISIS or ISIL, as the president says? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. What jumped out at you about the president's address last night? What do you agree with most? What are the four questions that you would put on your list? 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook. Join us after a short break. Continued discussion with Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of the University of Iowa at the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we are back on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, two of our regular astute political analysts who pore over things. And of course, lately, things very interesting in Iowa and across the country. Last night, the president giving his final State of the Union address. We're asking you to chip in with your comments, your questions about any aspect that the president brought out in his final address to Congress. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or we are on Facebook. We left off with the military and foreign policy. The president saying last night in answer to some of his critics, the United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth, period, he said. It's not even close. It's not even close, he repeated. And he said again, it's not even close. Jeff in West Des Moines, I think you had a question that went along with the security issues that the president mentioned last night.
I did. And first of all, I would say it's not even close, but certainly through nothing that President Obama has done,
mm-hmm.
Are we not even close in spite of that. But my first thought was I kept looking at my watch, wondering when is he eventually going to get to national security issues, and it seemed to be about 45 minutes in before he finally did, which I thought was an example of how detached he is with my priorities and with what I read in the polls, some other Americans' priorities. But when he talks about not being an existential threat, I think it's illustrative of what happened after the attack in Paris, the fact that the French president was so enraged by what had happened there, and he went to the EU to activate their mutual defense policy, but did not do the same thing to NATO. And I think it's probably because he had been tipped off that President Obama would have blocked that, because he doesn't want to get further involved in this. And I think that's exactly what NATO was there for. And if we're not going to stand up with our friends against an enemy like this, I think we can only expect that enemy to expand and grow.
Mm. Jeff, interesting remarks from West Des Moines. Donna, what do you think about that? The president, in Jeff's estimation, not giving enough weight to security issues.
Well, I would say, just because I do analyze these speeches, that it typically is the case that presidents put foreign policy last in these speeches. You know, part of that is a calculation, because the American public tends to, not always, but tends to care more about domestic policy issues. And so it is very rare that you get a State of the Union address in which foreign policy issues are discussed in the first half of the speech. And so that's actually not an anomaly in that regard. In terms of, you know, the structure of the international sphere, more or less, comparing the EU to NATO, I know the president in one section of the speech did talk about, you know, getting out of the Cold War mindset, which NATO was created after World War II. And I think that just is in keeping with how he views the new structure. He talked about the biggest challenge that we have is not states, but failed states. And that's where the terrorism is flourishing, if you will. And so he sees the international sphere kind of as a post-Cold War international sphere. And the NATO entity was a collective bargaining entity that arose out of that. And so I think that's just a different way that Obama perceives kind of the international sphere at the moment. And in particular, in talking about, you know, you played the clip previously from talking about ISIL, he talked about his strategy, which is not a go in with boots on the ground strategy, but is one that's nuanced with airstrikes, coalition building. And that's somewhat different. And Obama has had trouble selling that in particular, and has been open to criticism from Republicans that he's not forceful enough. And that's just his foreign policy style, I would argue. And certainly it's not going to make everybody happy.
Mm-hmm. From Jeff in West Des Moines, let's go to Hayes. Hayes joining us from Carroll, Iowa. Hi, Hayes.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome to our program.
Hi. I just wanted to dispute what your first caller said in regards to ISIS, a threat similar to ISIS, being exactly what NATO was intended to handle, because it certainly is not. And as a registered Republican, it seems to me foreign policy is about the one area on which I agree with the president, and I applaud him for his non-interventionist approach, and being a little more restrained in his use of that most powerful military in the world. You know, for the last 30 years, our foreign policy has been so interventionist, and it's led a lot of people in the world to see us as meddling and using that powerful military as our main negotiating tool, as a threat. And I think that's a huge liability for Republicans. Mm-hmm. And applaud President Obama, and just wanted to clarify your
right. And Hayes,
NATO was intended for.
And Hayes, just to follow up quickly, I'm guessing you're seeing the Republican candidates. You said you're a registered Republican through this lens, and many of them making remarks that are not isolationist, more interventionist.
They are, and I see that as one of many huge liabilities for most of our Republican candidates, when there is certainly a small and vocal fraction of the American public who like to see, you know, a very interventionist type of policy, but the majority of Americans do not, and I believe that's fleshed out all the time. You know, we don't want The majority of Americans don't want our soldiers fighting and dying in a country that most of us don't believe we have any business being in the first place. Is it our responsibility to protect people who need protected? Absolutely.
Okay.
Is it our responsibility to police the world? Certainly not.
Yeah, exactly. One of the president's questions last night, how do we keep America safe and lead the world without becoming its policeman? Thank you very much, Hayes in Carroll. Let's move on to another part of this speech. The president, in one of his little jabs, I guess he's known for in his speeches, President Obama compared action to address climate change to the space race. Have a listen to this.
60 years ago, when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny Sputnik was up there. We didn't argue about the science or shrink our research and development budget. We built a space program almost overnight, and 12 years later, we were walking on the moon.
So, Tim Hagel, the president really here saying, let's look at climate change and making remarks, too, that the people who deny that's going on or deny man's action in that. I don't particularly remember his remark, but he was making the point that this should be viewed as an opportunity in his view.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is that later in the speech he talks about how the concern about the partisanship and not being able to bring people together, and he doesn't really take the blame for that necessarily, but this is an area where that occurs because if there, you know, some people have what at least they believe to be legitimate concerns about whether the science is accurate regarding climate change or what the effects are, what the cause is, or what can be done about it. And those folks tend to get shouted down and drowned out rather than having their concerns addressed. Now, if their concerns are unreasonable, then it's understandable. You can't really have a discussion. But on the other hand, there are reasonable people that do have concerns along these lines. And mm-hmm. they basically make the assumption that, well, if you disagree with us, then you must be a nut or a kook or something like that, or a denier, climate change denier. I like to use that
but
phrase.
But he also made comments about clean energy, economic opportunities, presenting in places like Iowa.
And this is the way that you could try to bring people together. You say, well, look, well, maybe you don't necessarily agree on climate change or things of that nature, but certainly less carbon in the atmosphere is a good thing. Less pollution is a good thing. And let's take it from there. And what can we do? And how can we do things in a way that helps the economy rather than hurts the economy in some ways, and make your case that way? And maybe that's the way to do it.
Okay. I wanted to get to a remark the president ended his speech on with a hopeful tone, although he admitted he hadn't succeeded in one area. Donna, I'd love to have your reaction to this, where he had promised to end political rancor when we listened to the 2008 campaign speeches. Now, 8 years later, here's what the president is sounding like.
But democracy does require basic bonds of trust between its citizens. It doesn't work if we think the people who disagree with us are all motivated by malice. It doesn't work if we think that our political opponents are unpatriotic or are trying to weaken America. Democracy grinds to a halt without a willingness to compromise, or when even basic facts are contested, or when we listen only to those who agree with us. Our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get all the attention. And most of all, democracy breaks down when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter, that the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest. Too many Americans feel that way right now. It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office. But my fellow Americans, this cannot be my task or any president's alone.
The president last night toward the end of his State of the Union address. What did you think of that, Donna Hoffman, the expression of this great regret in his presidency?
Well, I thought that was, really quite interesting. And in that second section where his goal is to, have politics reflect the best in us, not the worst in us, He talks about, you know, look, this is a government of the Constitution begins with we the people. And so in that section in particular, he talks about how, look, people, it's up to you. It's up to you. It depends on you. There, in that clip, you heard him say it's not just up to me.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes on to talk about how the people have to demand changes. And, you know, if you want this to end, people have to demand this. I'll continue to work for it. I could do better. And, you know, so I think that was Obama being, you know, quite forthright in sharing the fact that he's been very frustrated with the fact that he wanted to change the rancor, if you will, in Washington. And he wasn't able to do that. And in fact, it probably grew during his period of time. But that doesn't mean, I mean, it takes two to tango in that sense. So there's a lot of intervening factors there in terms of how that happened. And it's a continuation of a larger trend that happened even before Obama arrived on the scene. But he brought it back. He addressed public cynicism. He brought it back to the people and say, look, you people, it's government, you know, of you. You have to demand this change. And that's where the real challenge lies.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, this is the part of the speech, as I was saying before, where he was attempting to be more inspirational. And I think that most people could agree with the sentiments that he was espousing here. The problem was, and Republicans were pretty quick to point out, that in large measure that President Obama caused some of that rancor in terms of demonizing the other side on one issue or another. Now, you can disagree with that, and not all Republicans would necessarily agree with that criticism. But you do see that where candidates in particular, and I guess you can understand it in the context of an election where you're trying to distinguish yourself either from the other party or from other candidates within your own party, that you are hitting on the negative notes a little bit harder and you're trying to make those divisions. And we see this in a variety of ways where you have that rancor, that negativity, and it's hard to get past it.
I would just add here that, you know, this didn't begin with Obama. We had it with George W. Bush. We had it with Clinton, where you really saw, you know, this bare-knuckled political fighting, you know, really trying to stop a president's agenda. Clinton encountered it. Bush encountered it. Obama has encountered it. And so there's enough blame there in terms of that rancor to go around for both sides. Yeah, I think Obama was wanting to basically say, we have gotten to the point that this can't continue to go on. The people have to demand change. I tried, didn't work. You know, it's up to you. And he's addressing the fact that the public is very cynical about politics. We're seeing that in terms of what's happening in the presidential nomination race. And he's, you know, really trying to address this trend that is getting worse.
Right. And speaking of that, what's happening in the 2016 race as we wind down this hour in the Republican response, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley spoke about her own immigrant experience and seemed to take a swipe. Well, she took some swipes at Obama, but she took a good swipe at some of the anti-immigrant campaign rhetoric from her own party.
My story is really not much different from millions of other Americans. Immigrants have been coming to our shores for generations to live the dream that is America. They wanted better for their children than for themselves. That remains the dream of all of us. And in this country, we have seen time and again that dream is achievable. Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation. No one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country.
Okay, Nikki Haley with the Republican response. I saw Tim Hagel this morning, Donald Trump tweeting out his favorite mode of attack, a response to Nikki Haley. He evidently felt spoken to in that case, said, I think, Nikki Haley, weak on immigration.
Yeah, and basically Governor Haley, in fact, indicated that she was more or less referring to Trump in that particular exchange. And Nikki, just more generally in terms of her response, it was a very good one. Usually these things are difficult to give because it's a different format. It's a shorter format. You're staring into a camera, not talking to people in a room. And that's very difficult. And she did a very good job, very straightforward.
Sounded less partisan than they usually
less
are.
Less partisan. She recognized some of the problems even within her own party. And as a result, I think came across very well.
Mm-hmm. Donna?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, the advantage here, the GOP in the last several years has tried to highlight the diversity within their party. And here you get somebody who has executive experience. She's a governor. She's female. Her family immigrated from India. And so she did do a very good job. And as Tim mentioned, this is a following any president is a hard act to follow because of the difference in the format there. But I think it was pretty well received. And in particular, because she did address the fact that within the party, there are some odd things happening that are getting, again, back to what Obama talked about in terms of that rancor, and that both parties have some responsibility there.
Okay. In the remaining few minutes we have, let's talk about the latest polls. A new Des Moines Register, Bloomberg Politics, Iowa poll showing with less than 20 days before the caucuses, Ted Cruz at the front of the Republican candidates in Iowa, among likely caucus goers, 25%. Donald Trump, just 3 percentage points behind at 22%. I think that's within the margin of error. Marco Rubio, 12%. Ben Carson, 11%. Tim Hagel, quickly, what do you see in these poll numbers on the GOP side?
Well, we're starting to see a little bit of separation. You have kind of a top tier with Trump and Cruz, a middle tier with Rubio and Carson, and then sort of everybody else lagging behind. I still think Carson's going to have a difficult time, doesn't seem to have the ground game. Rubio doesn't either, so we still may see some of those other folks move up. I think Rand Paul's organization is going to outperform what his poll numbers suggest. And the big question right now is whether the Trump supporters are sufficiently enthusiastic that they'll actually turn out for him without as solid a ground game as the Cruz supporters have.
Mm-hmm. Donna, with these poll numbers in mind, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, again, I'd echo what Tim just said. The real question is whether Trump's supporters will actually caucus for him. And I think that'll be really interesting to watch.
Okay. For months on the Democratic side, we've seen how Sanders has had a slight edge in New Hampshire, while Clinton has had a slightly larger lead here in Iowa. But a new Quinnipiac University poll out yesterday of Iowa Democrats showing Sanders pulling ahead of the front runner by 3 percentage points, also, I believe, within the margin of error. At the same time, a new Monmouth University poll of New Hampshire Democrats found the Vermont senator expanding his lead there to a whopping 14 percentage points. Hillary Clinton telling the Today Show this morning, "No, I'm not nervous at all." What do you think, Donna? Should Clinton be nervous? Does Bernie have the momentum?
Bernie does have some momentum, but Clinton also, you know, earlier in the week was lowering expectations in terms of Iowa as well, saying that they've always known that it's going to be a fight. So, you know, Bernie has some momentum. Whether he can sustain that or not is an open question. You know, we do have people in the caucus on the Democratic side that will be somewhat fluid. I think there's more fluidity probably in terms of Republican caucus goers at the moment. But Sanders is certainly putting a lot of effort into the state. But Hillary Clinton did learn at least somewhat of a lesson from 2008 and is not taking her frontrunner status or the state of Iowa for she's not taking it for granted. And so they are putting a lot of effort and resources into the state. I believe Bill Clinton's going to be in the state to campaign for her as well. And so, you know, we have 18 days to go and we'll see lots of ads. We'll see lots of people in the state campaigning for themselves and for their surrogates campaigning for them as well. And so it's still, you know, very, very interesting to watch. And Sanders certainly does have some momentum in the state, I think.
Right. In fact, at a rally in Ames yesterday, Clinton told supporters it's time to, in her words, get real about the differences between her and Sanders. Here's a quote. "I think we're in that stage of the campaign where we've been introducing ourselves and we've been talking about our particular views on issues. Now it's time to draw some contrasts." So it'll be a change in these final days, Tim Hagel, you think?
Well, as Dana was saying, that there doesn't seem to be quite as much fluidity. And the big question, and what Hillary Clinton's comment was getting at there, is the electability issue. And this is something that sort of dogs Sanders. But he's been addressing it as well, suggesting that, look, I am, in fact, electable. And he has his supporters, on average, tend to have more enthusiasm for him than perhaps the Clinton folks do. And that's going to be another key when it comes time for turnout on caucus night.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, Donna, how much of an echo is this of 2008 with Clinton facing someone with a late surge in popularity?
I think there's a decent amount of difference there because Sanders isn't Obama, and I don't think his organization is quite as good as Obama's was in the state. at that point, and you don't have the Edwards factor this time around that you had in 2008 as well. And so while there are some interesting comparisons there to be made, and certainly for Hillary Clinton to not take the state for granted, but I don't think Sanders is Obama.
Okay, fascinating analysis from Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, where she's associate professor, Tim Hagel, associate professor at the University of Iowa. It's always great to have you join us in our studios in Iowa City and Cedar Falls. Donna, Tim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us for Politics Day. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow.